I'd like to call to order today's meeting of the Public Safety Policy Judiciary Finance Committee today. Clerk, would you take the roll?
Chairman Smith?
Present.
Representative Eastland? Cornish?
Here.
Ellison? Hosman? Hillstrom?
Here.
Johnson? Meslow? Murphy?
Here.
Newman?
Here.
Tamar?
Here.
Sodstrom?
Here.
January 13, 2005, Chair knows that we have a presence of a quorum, so the first thing we'll look at is consideration of the minutes from the January 12, 2005 meeting. They're in the packet. Any questions? Is there a motion? Representative Newman moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion? If not, those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. The first item on our agenda... I would like to remind the members that we have scheduled for next week Friday an overview that we're entitling Law School for Legislators, and I'd like to introduce a gentleman, and I'll give a brief background of Mr. Flegel. He will tell us about the law school. His background includes the following. He is a 1979 graduate of the University of Minnesota. He has authored 5 textbooks, over 120 articles, many of which have been cited by the Minnesota Appellate Courts. In 2001 and 2003, he moderated a similar law school for legislators at William Mitchell College of Law, presenting a civil justice symposium to State House and Senate members and their staffs. He is a member of the American Board of Trial Advocates. He's board certified as a civil trial specialist by the National Board of Trial Advocacy and the Minnesota State Bar Association. He is listed in Law and Leading American Attorneys and has been recognized as a, quote, super lawyer in both trials and appeals, as well as one of the top 10 attorneys in Minnesota by polls in law and politics. He has served as chair of the state's Campaign Finance and Public Disclosure Board twice since his appointment in 1998 and since 1999, has been a member of the Minnesota Supreme Court's No-Fault Arbitration Standing Committee. Mr. Flegel.
Thank you, Chairman Smith. Members, good morning. My name is Will Flegel, and I'm here very briefly this morning to remind you, as Chair Smith has, of the upcoming Civil Law Symposium, or so-called Law School for Legislators. This is the third occasion in which we've had the opportunity to present to you a white paper background on the function of the civil law system and its interaction with the administrative and criminal system of justice. On this occasion, we'll be presenting on Friday, January the 21st, in conjunction with the William Mitchell College of Law, and provide a general background, introduction to civil law, as well as we are going to have on our panel of experts to present the state court administrator, who will outline the current structure and function, the demands upon the justice system in terms of the number and types of cases and different aspects of litigation which are presently occupying our court system, hopefully provide some general background and aid to you in determining allocation of resources. Also, as has typically been the case over the course of the last 3 symposia that we presented, we were asked to present on some substantive law topics to hopefully provide aid or background to you as you address potential changes coming before you. We're going to present to you in part on the concepts of civil commitment within a criminal law context, family law background, election law background, and also the tort system. These are matters that we've covered in a presentation. As I said, this is our third occasion to present to you, and we're very pleased to be able to do that. In addition to the oral presentations, we do develop a booklet which may serve as a written resource, a collection of white papers setting forth the general organization and function of our justice system. And we're pleased to present that to you, and I hope you find it beneficial. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing us to present this morning.
Mr. Flegel, thank you. Are there any questions at this time? If not, we appreciate it very much, and we'll see you that day.
Kindly.
And just as a matter of policy or interest, Representative Pamar and others, the CLE credits will be applied for, and they have been applied for and granted in the past. I think 5 is the amount. Thank you. And also, if any of the members are going to attend, we would appreciate, notifying our committee administrators so we can plan on the number, because there will be a lunch provided. All right, let's move along to then the Department of Corrections. Commissioner Joan Fabian, Deputy Commissioner Dennis Benson, Deputy Commissioner Harley Nelson, who will give us an overview, and looks like we're going to be discussing bed space projections, budget impact, but first, the fiscal year 05 deficiency request. We'd like to hear a report on that and give the committee an opportunity to ask any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And committee members, we really appreciate the opportunity to be here today to update you on our many challenges, and I'm sure you've been hearing that from other departments, too. We'll begin with the projections many times. We'll begin with the projections because that really gets to our the heart of all the rest of our issues. So I think I'll introduce Dennis Benson. I think most of you know Dennis. He's been around for 31 years and 8 months and 2 days. He keeps telling me every day. So he's been long on experience here. And Dan Storkamp is also here, who is very instrumental in getting our projections together. And I think most of you have met Deputy Commissioner Harley Nelson, a boy from Hala. Okay.
Well, Mr. Chair and members, I'm Dennis Benson, a Deputy Commissioner of the institution side of the department. And as the Commissioner said, we're going to spend a few moments on population projections and growth. As you know, we do projections every year. We try to get them completed by around Thanksgiving to give us a snapshot of what we can expect during the upcoming year. I don't think it's any secret that we've experienced incredible growth the last 5 years. We've got a slide here that will indicate our population has gone up about 45% in the last 5 years. And we're going to start by just giving you a brief understanding of how projections are done in the state of Minnesota, and then we'll get into some of the real numbers. So Dan is going to begin.
Mr. Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, Information and Technology Director for the Department of Corrections. Today we're going to cover the prison population projections, and thanks for that opportunity to present today. What we're going to do is we're going to give a quick overview of the model, what projections are showing, factors that are impacting on the projections, including meth and admissions, accuracy, and then end on some bed space issues. Just so the committee knows, projections really are to identify those that are committed to the Commissioner of Corrections over the next 10 years. We use we use the projections in the Department of Corrections for operation purposes, as well as for our budget adjustment that's done on an annual basis from the Department of Department of Finance. The projections are completed annually with Sentencing Guidelines Commission. They are based on current laws, current trends, and current practices. I want to repeat that. Current laws, current trends, and current practices. The realistic picture is we're projecting what we currently are doing and what our current laws say. So anything in addition that the legislature debates this year, as far as meth, as far as sex offenders, as far as indeterminate sentencing, would be above and beyond what I'm presenting today as far as the numbers. And we work with guidelines in doing bed impacts, and we'll present those to you on each of your respective bills. But that's in addition to what you're seeing today. In the simplest description, projections really are who's in prison and when they're going to get out, as well as who will be coming into prison. While it's a simple process, we've got a complex model that we've worked with for many years to help identify who those offenders are and how many we're going to have over the years. This model was designed back in the 1980s by a professor at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Ron Anderson, and he has updated the model several times. And while it's been updated, the model still produces the projections as they did originally, in, again, looking at those that are committed to the Commissioner of Corrections and identifying, from our perspective, where we're going to be putting those in the system. The model is driven by data, which means we're taking our admission and our base population, and that's how the model actually estimates into the future how many beds we need. And it includes such factors as additions into the model, the base population, discipline increases, probation violations, projected admissions, pre-sentence investigation holds, and supervised release violations. In addition, we take things out of the model that account for individuals being in other programs that were legislatively mandated, like our challenged incarceration program, where they serve a part of their time incarcerated, and then they're intensively supervised in phase 2 and 3. We do work release, and short-term offenders are the new component that have been added this past year to projections. The projections, as I indicated, are historical-based. It's what currently is happening in projecting the future. So when we're looking at the history of what's happening, we start with that chart.
Mr. Chair and members, again, as I mentioned, this slide is a historical perspective, and it kind of underscores the 45% growth going back to 1999. If you look at the numbers between the years in the bars, you can see that we, between 99 and 2000, we grew by 510, and certainly that number increased each year as we get to 2004. Between 2003 and July of 2004, our population increased by 765 offenders. We think that this is very relevant to the discussion today, particularly the deficiency budget requests that the department has on the table. Again, this kind of growth is unprecedented in certainly recent years with respect to the Department of Corrections, and certainly has provided some unique challenges for the agency in terms of finding corresponding beds, meeting health care needs, and just managing this kind of very significant growth in a system that historically has been, comparatively speaking, somewhat small to similarly sized states. And we'll get into some state comparisons when we get into our overview here in a few moments.
As Dennis showed the historical view, actually one other component of the history is the short-term offenders. As of July 1, we would have had another 272 additional offenders in prison if short-term offenders were not being held locally. So that would have been an increase of over 1,000 offenders if they were added in. As Dennis pointed out, on the left side of the chart here is the same chart as Dennis was indicating. It showed the 45% increase from 1999 to 2004. What we're showing from 2004 to 2010 over the next 6 years is another 33% increase in our prison population projections. I do want to point out a note at the bottom that we are dealing with those that are housed by a Department of Correction or housed in a Department of Corrections facility or contracted to be housed in a local or private facility. This does not does not include the short-term offenders there above and beyond these numbers. And that's a slight change from previous years, so the numbers may be slightly off from previous charts you may have seen. On the next chart, what we're trying to show here is the difference between males and females. Females account for about 6% of the projections, and that continues up to the year 2010. Specifically, females are showing a dramatic increase in 2005 and 6 was 55 and then 44 and so on out. That is a 37% increase over the next 6 years for females. On the male chart, that's following a very similar pattern to the overall. Again, the males count for over 90% of the population, so they are going to follow that general trend. The reasons for projections. Looking at the number of commitments, new commitments coming in, we have seen a steady increase continuing. I think you saw from sentencing guidelines, dramatic increase in court dispositions between 2002 and 2003, which was a 20% increase, followed by another, I think it was 13% beyond that. We're showing the increases for this past year as well. Looking at our data, looking at admissions between January and June of this year compared to last year, we're seeing a 4% increase in new court commitments, and we're seeing a 23% increase in release return violators coming back to prison. And we got some charts in a moment to show about that. But in addition to the numbers, the average length of time offenders are coming back for short-term or for release returns is a month longer. So not only do we have more, but they're also coming back longer. You also saw, I think earlier this week in sentencing guidelines, the sentencing of new court commitments has also increased over the years. Matter of fact, in 1990 it was an average of 45 months, in 95 it was an average of 48 months, In 2000, it was an average of 49 months, and this past year that they had in 2003 was 51 months on average. That plays into the projections as well.
A couple of the drivers, as we have discussed in the last couple of years, are drug offenders and sex offenders. These two graphs certainly underscore the fact that these two crime categories are increasing, and certainly into the future are probably projected to increase as well. If you look at the chart on the left, the drug offenders, back in 1990, we were at just over 200 offenders. Today, we're pushing 2,000. And the subset of the drug offenders, about 50% are methamphetamine offenders. So that really is an epidemic in the state of Minnesota and is a significant part of the drug offenders that come to prison in the state of Minnesota. Also, as you can see on the chart on the right, the sex offenders, that has been steadily increasing over time, and certainly one of the drivers there are the continued enhancements to the sex offender statutes over the course of the last 15 years has resulted in not only more people coming to prison but staying a little bit longer. This chart, as we begin to look at the drug offenders, the category that bubbles to the surface are methamphetamine offenders. This topic, I'm sure, will get a lot of attention this session, and probably should, just based on the, again, the incredible growth. The significant pieces to this chart, I think, besides the growth, are the fact that about 72% of them, it's their first trip to prison. 52% have no prior felony conviction, and then 72% are from non-metro counties. So it's a unique crime category for us, but certainly one that we think is needs to be addressed. It's obviously a very dangerous controlled substance in a variety of different ways in terms of the pollution factor, the kids that get involved, the health care costs that go along with it, and not only that, but it's also a difficult addiction to treat. There's also medical opinions that are starting to surface that indicate that it could cause brain damage. So there's, I think, lots of reasons to pay attention to this. But from our perspective, we become the repository for these people. We're obviously very interested in trying to do the right thing as well in terms of treatment, medical care, aftercare. One of the things that we do know is that treatment can work for methamphetamines and does work, but the component that is critical to successful treatment is the aftercare component. Can't just go through 30 days of treatment and expect that it's going to work. The other thing we're starting to hear from the professionals is people have to detox for a significant period of time before they enter treatment as well. We were recently up at the boot camp, and the offenders up there said, I really needed to be in prison for a while before I entered treatment to clear my head. And the very interesting thing about our boot camp is about 95% are meth offenders.
Commissioner Benson, excuse me, question. Representative Paymer, you had a question.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, on the slide before on the drug offenders and the sex offenders, Deputy Commissioner, did you say that there was an increase in sex offenses or statewide over this 10-year period of time, or are you saying that sex offenders are being held in our institutions for a longer period of time?
Mr. Chair, okay. Representative Paymer, what you're seeing here are those that are being held.
So there's not an increase. We're not seeing more people committing sex offenses.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paymer, we need to probably check the sentencing guidelines on that number, but we can get that for you.
Okay, but I understand what you're saying is that they'll be held for longer periods of time.
Correct.
Thank you.
Commissioner Benson or Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair and members, as I mentioned, the admissions are one of the components the Department of Corrections watches very closely on a monthly basis, looking at the increases. And there was a steady increase in admissions. If you take a look at the year 2000, we were averaging just over 900, 920 in that range per quarter. In 2003, that range was over 1,000, and in 2004, the first two quarters were over 1,100, and even quarter three, which was slightly less than the first two, is higher than any quarter prior to 2004. One thing to note in these numbers, short-term offenders, I think that was a question that was raised at her earlier hearing. When we did our projections on, or the impact of short-term offenders and locals, we were estimating 200-220 total. We were estimating that based on the admissions of somewhere between 170 and 180 admissions per quarter. Starting July of 2003, when the short-term offender went into effect, the number of admissions dramatically increased to an average of 240 to 260 in that range. And as a result, we're seeing anywhere between 250 and 270 in local facilities. As I mentioned, release returns are also dramatically up. In quarter 1, 2, and 3 for quarter, or 2004, we're averaging somewhere around 500. Where previous years it was under 450, 430 in that range.
Mr. Chair.
This next slide.
Excuse me, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry. Going back to the slide about the short-term offenders, do we know now that there is adequate space to address those, or have we been made aware of issues at your level about space now that we're sending those prisoners on to the local level?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hillstrom, they are being handled. There's no question that there's also crowding in local jails, but there hasn't been major issues. Now, there could be in some jails that are at capacity and they have to actually find other bed space in other jails and purchase beds for them, but they're handling it. The other thing that they're able to do, too, if they're short-term offenders and they can look at their risk level and so forth, they can treat them like they do their own prisoners, and some of them can be put out on electronic monitoring, and there's ways that they can deal with those population problems. But many of them are being handled fairly well. I'm sure there are some problems, though I can't say that that's across the board. But it's not major issues.
Mr. Storkamp.
Mr. Chair and members, one last thing about projections and kind of where we're going. We took a look for the first time working with sentencing guidelines at the next 10 years and started breaking those out by offense types. It's the first time we've ever done this in Minnesota. And what we're finding is that about 45% of the increase over the next 10 years is due to drugs, and two-thirds of that is due to methamphetamine. About 40% are for person offenders and 15% for others. So that gives you kind of a context of what's going to be impacting on the future Department of Corrections.
This next slide gives a historical perspective of the accuracy of our projections model. It's always nice if we can hit it right on the nose every year in terms of how many offenders we expect to come into prison, but it's very difficult when the rules sort of change every year with respect to new sentencing enhancements. We try to measure or predict what will result in a law change, for instance, the DUI law, which was a pretty significant change. Fortunately, in that particular instance, we were pretty close. I believe we have about 330 DUIers in our system today. We predict that at the top of that particular crime category will be just over 500, I believe, 560 DUIers. But it's that kind of thing that changes from year to year to year. As you, most of you know, we've had somewhere around 100 sentencing enhancements in the last 15 years. Some of those, it took many years to impact the agency in terms of bed space. So we've been watching those numbers and getting some experience. But some of the shorter sentences, it's much more difficult to predict. But having said that, this graph shows that in 2000-2001, we actually over-projected. Fewer people came than we thought by about 1%, 1.3%. And then in 2002, we actually got many more people into the system than we projected. by about 5.5%. And that year, particular year, court volume increased by about 20%, which historically the increase had been much, much lower. And again, it was a phenomenon that was very difficult for us to predict. And then in 2003, we were off by just 0.6%. In 2004, 2.9. So our margin of error is somewhere between about 1 and up to 3% in terms of an average. We think that this model has served the state of Minnesota very well, but despite that, we are we put another model on the table, and we're going to use two models now and try to validate, use a second model to validate our first model, make some adjustments, and see if we can get this as accurate as possible, not only for budgeting purposes, but bed space planning purposes as well. Just kind of a state of the agency in terms of where we're at with bed space. I don't think it's any surprise we had this discussion last year, but all of our beds at our existing physical plants are filled. We have no more room in the 8 adult facilities. We actually even have 60 adults at Red Wing. They're isolated in a cottage. We've done that from time to time over the past 15 years. We are renting, I believe, just under 100 beds from county jails, Morrison County, Nobles County, and Kaneohe County. And we're also renting 150 beds from the Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton. Our longer-range plan talks about filling up the Prairie Correctional Facility. If the current trend continues, we should have Prairie filled by July of 2007. So as we get into the bonding initiatives, you can understand how critical the Faribault initiative is, because we are simply out of options once the private facility at Appleton is filled. This last slide, I believe, or second to last slide, again, is kind of our bed space plan for the foreseeable future. Currently, we have 250 held locally in that Prairie. The next 2 years, we are going to, the next biennium, we will fill Prairie. If we need a few extra beds, we hope we can find them from county jails. There are a couple of other counties that have indicated they may have some beds. They're doing some expansion. We may be able to rent some additional beds. And then in 2007, if Faribault is bonded this year, we talked to our architectural firm yesterday. They believe by the last quarter of 2007, those 700 beds could come online. That's phase one. Phase two is the last 359. That would come on a couple of years later. So, again, as Dan suggested, given current law, current practices, this would cover us through 2010. However, this doesn't include the crime bill that was on the table last year that I'm sure will be debated again this session. That will be over and above in terms of our bed space needs. So any additional laws or enhancements that are passed, we'll have to find a corresponding bed somewhere in our system. And then the last slide is just kind of looking ahead. What are the what are we doing now, and what are the options? As I mentioned, privatization, renting from local county jails, and Faribault Phase 1 and Phase 2 is our five-year plan. Beyond that, we have Shakopee down there, because next year we are going to have to talk about expanding Shakopee. There's a cottage down there we can expand. The last expansion down there, we only built one unit instead of two. We could add 62 beds at Shakopee. We do need to find some space for female offenders as well. The other options that we are discussing internally are St. Cloud has a lot of land available. We could expand at St. Cloud. Rush City, we can still add two units at Rush City to give us 550 beds. Moose Lake, we would have the capability of maybe adding one or two K buildings at 416 offenders each. And then, of course, we can always consider a new public facility or additional privatization. A lot of what will drive that decision is at what custody level do we need the beds? And currently, we have about 900 medium custody or level 3 offenders who are actually being housed in a level 4 facility. So that begs the need to expand at Faribault as well. That's a level 3, a medium, so we could get more of those medium custody inmates in a medium custody facility.
Commissioner Betson, excuse me, Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was surprised to see you list privatization and mention it several times. I sort of recall our discussion in bonding last year that those of you in the profession were giving us some reasons not to go in that direction. Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, we think that right now it isn't a matter of either or with Appleton. We absolutely have to have that as well as the expansion at Faribault. And what we are planning to do and what we already have started, we have 150 inmates at Appleton right now. By the end of 07, there'll be 1,350. I think it's going to give us a very good opportunity to look and see how that's working. I think it would be, not responsible to not try it out, see how it works, because we absolutely were forced into it at this point. We have to fill that at this point because of our overpopulation. So I think it gives us a real good, responsible way to look at it and to look and see how it's going.
And Mr. Chair, I was reacting more to his second comment when he said, and perhaps more privatization. I was hearing a different sort of future than you had envisioned for us in another committee sit on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hausman, I think it's important to leave all options open and to look at it. So I think we have it listed as options, and I think we need to look at all options.
Representative Eastland, and then Murphy. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess any of you can answer. How do the numbers that we currently have in our prisons line up with the different level 2, level 3, level 4 categories? I mean, how many do we have in each category right now of the inmates that we have in prison?
The levels of sex offender levels?
No, I mean our level of incarceration that we have for...
Mr. Chair and members... Okay. Representative Eastland, we have, as you know, three level 3 institutions, Moose Lake, Lino Lakes, and Faribault. That's our biggest problem in terms of we're deficient in the number of level 3 beds that we have. As I said, we have about 900 more level 3 offenders than we have room for right now. The exact breakdown, I don't have available to me right now. I can certainly get that for you, but I can tell you that we're in pretty good shape with the exception of level 3. And again, this expansion will pretty much put everybody where they need to be in terms of their custody classification. But we can certainly get the committee a breakdown of how many we have at level 5, how many we have at level 4, 3, 2, and 1.
Okay, the follow-up.
Representative Eastland.
And then on the last slide, am I understanding this to be that you're expecting an increase of like 700 inmates a year? Is that what we're looking at here, something like that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, for the next year we're showing a 700-bed increase. Following years will be slightly or less than that, again, given current laws. If there are additional sentencing beyond or policy changes that occur this year, that would be on top of. So if the current trend of 700 continues into the future, that's what we're showing there.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Eastland.
And then what is the demographic makeup of that group as they fit into the levels of our security? Do we know?
Mr. Chair and Representative Eastland, we don't have that right now, but it's something we can look at and see if we can get you.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Murphy.
Mr. Chair, just
as a response to the answer to Representative Houghton's question, if you're thinking of revising your slide, Mr. Storkamp, I would suggest that you take privatization off of that last one where after Moose Lake. Also, Mr. Chair, and
This is a policy committee as well as a finance committee, commissioners, and I'm not going to go on that issue today, but we'll probably be discussing that down the road as well.
And
Representative Murphy,
Commissioner, have you prepared any bills from the Department of Corrections? We call them department bills that would lessen the projected numbers of people coming into the prison?
Mr. Chair,
for our consideration,
Representative Murphy, no, we haven't.
Do you have any ideas?
Got a lot of ideas.
Then we should book a lot. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative Murphy. I'm looking at this chart too, and maybe we need to firmly and strongly reconsider expanding Faribault so we don't see things like privatization or new private facility on these slides. Do you have additional information? I have a question on one of the first slides. I think it's your 1, 2, 3, 4th slide showing Minnesota adult prison populations July 1 of each year, the bar graph. And I'm looking at the total numbers of projections, I guess, with 05 being 733 increase, 06 657, and then for the next 3 years you're about half of that. What's your projected reason for the projected cut in half increase?
Mr. Chair and members, that's a very good question. When looking at the projections and who's coming into the future, what's going to be happening is some of that increases that are showing in 2005 and 2006 are people that will eventually get out, and there'll be people filling in behind them. Therefore, what you're seeing here is, under current law, people funneling into the system, staying for 2, 3, 4 years and getting out, and new people coming in would fill those beds. So you're only seeing those increases for the first year. This is actually not showing what the cumulative effect is. If you're looking at 2004 to 2006, the cumulative effect of increase will be over 1,300 beds.
Mr. Chair, I would also add
I didn't get that. Why are we looking at it? I'm just curious why at 06, for the next 4 years, there appears to be a projected substantial lessening of the growth. And what is that? How has that come about? What is the projected reason? You just told me, but say it again in English.
Mr. Chair and members, apologize. Let me see if I can describe it another way. When an individual comes in for a 2-year sentence and we're showing an increase of 100 of those individuals, we're going to show that increase for the next 2 years, but some of those individuals start getting out of prison, and new people coming in sentenced under that same law will fill in behind them. So the first 700 beds are showing that we're needing the 700 for that first 100 individuals. Beyond that, what's going to happen is some of those individuals are going to start getting out and others are going to start coming in and filling in behind them.
Is that a particular kind of a crime that constitutes what looks like this and then looks like this?
Mr. Chair and members, a large part of the increase coming up are meth offenders, and DWI offenders are a part of that as well. They have an average of 50 months, the DWI offenders. Meth offenders are about 80 months. So you're going to see a lot of those increases for 3 years, 2 years, 4 years, in that range. And then people are going to start getting out, and others are going to start filling in. So we could break that out by offense type if you'd like to take a look at that.
It might be helpful if it doesn't take forever for you to do. Commissioner Benson?
Mr. Chair, again, from from my perspective, and I don't do projections, but just based on the 10 years I've been down here and watching these numbers, this is not uncommon that the further out we go, the lower the numbers are. But what has historically happened is every year there have been a couple of new sentencing enhancements which will jack those out years back up. So if you look historically at the population growth, it has, I can't remember a year that it's gone down. It keeps going up, up, up. So if history repeats itself, and this year and next year and the year after there are additional sentencing enhancements, my guess is those 380, 349, 318 numbers will be 400, 500, 600 if we continue to do what we have for the last 15 years. Because many of the drivers are those little bitty pieces that we've been here doing fiscal notes for a long time. And, you know, we see bills that, well, this one only adds 25 beds and this one only adds 40 beds or this one only adds 200 beds over 4 years. And it doesn't sound like much, but again, 15 years of that, pretty soon you got a cell block, pretty soon you got a prison, and then, of course, you have an epidemic like methamphetamine, which none of us were able to predict. It really does exacerbate our problem. And again, we're not saying that's a good thing or a bad thing, but again, from my perspective, that's what I've seen as I've watched these things grow over time, too. And the other reality is it's like the budget forecast. We're pretty good at projecting a year out. We can hit it pretty close. But 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, it just gets harder to project. I mean, the other thing that drives projections is our state population. We've had dramatic growth in the base of our state population the last 10, 15 years as well. We've had better law enforcement, more judges. We've had more aggressive prosecution. And all of those things, I think, add to the growth curve that we've experienced.
Thank you. Representative Murphy had a question.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sturkin, how many deaths do we have in the prisons each year? And has that been growing or not?
Mr. Chair and Representative Murphy, for the record, my name is Nan Schrader. I'm the Director of Health Services for the Department. This past calendar year, we had only 6 deaths. In the years prior, we've ranged around 12 to 14.
Representative Murphy.
Okay, thank you.
Very good. Representative Eastland and Houseman. And Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking at, on page 5, the yearly prison populations, the drug offenders. I wasn't here in the 80s, but I talked to Mr. Dival over there, and he said sometime in the late 80s is when we kind of had the crack cocaine initiatives, and so there was some sentencing enhancements that happened at that time. And then so what we're seeing there for the throughout the 90s is kind of the result of those sentencing enhancements and longer sentences and more offenders. And then at sometime around 2000, 2001, we had the methamphetamine started, and I think we bumped up some sentences at that time. And now we're going to be increasing those sentences again. This curve here is kind of an exponential curve. It's kind of from a mathematical analysis point of view here. What are the factors that are going to contain that? Is there a point in the time when we reach kind of saturation of the population for the number of people that are going to fall victim to this crime? Or do you have any information on that? I don't know.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, and members, other states have experienced the same phenomena that we're seeing in dramatic increases in meth, and they do see a leveling out at 4, 5, 6, 7 years in that range. We're anticipating at some point that we'll level out. Again, it's not just the numbers coming through, but increased sentences will also dramatically increase the numbers here.
Percent or numbers? Representative Houseman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. we get so compartmentalized in our committees that we look at impact under the purview of the budget and don't necessarily look beyond that. So when I look at the screens of reasons for dramatic changes and dramatic increase in release returns, I wonder if anyone in your industry is looking at insurance policies and insurance coverage for inpatient treatments. Are they more likely just to cover 10 days when they really need 21 days or something, and that we haven't done all we should be doing in the healthcare field to try to save some lives before they get to that point? Do you look at insurance company policies and their impact on your field?
Commissioner
Fabian. Representative Hausman, I know that Nan is on a committee that, you know, its departments are across department agencies. So it's a health care.
Ms. Schrader.
We, most of our offenders don't carry insurance in the year prior to coming. We did a survey three years ago, and probably less than 1% of our offenders had any kind of private health care insurance. It was, some was Medicaid, some was general assistance medical care, some was Minnesota care, but hardly any was private health insurance. generally, if they did have private health insurance, they were the employee, or they were the one who was carrying the insurance, and so very little dependent insurance. I think probably in the past year, I've maybe seen two offenders who had spouses who were carrying the insurance and they were the dependent. Yes, we work very closely. We work very closely with Human Services and with Human Services to get our offenders on certain health care programs as they're leaving our system. I'm sorry, that was your question?
So just the question occurs to me about cost-benefit analysis for a state reeling under a budget like this, say, would we do better to provide some state coverage of treatment that's automatically there at a level they require rather than deal with these expensive problems?
Mr. Chair, our offenders, by the sheer fact that they are in prison, are not eligible for Medicaid, so that pretty much eliminates all of that. And that's a federal rule, so we can't change that. But we've been working with DHS to figure out how we might get them on Medicaid as they're coming out of prison. They wouldn't be eligible for general assistance medical care. I think the other piece that's important is that we use a different standard of care in prison. MA has a whole benefit set. GAMC has a whole benefit set. We may not look at what is we may look at a benefit set that's a little bit different than MA or GAMC or Minnesota Care. We might not fix a hernia if somebody can perform their activities of daily living, whereas Medicaid might do that. Does that answer your question?
Well,
Representative
Hausman. I think so. What I'm saying is, is anybody looking at what you've just told us and saying, God, is there a cheaper way to try to intervene more aggressively? Not through Medicare, not through Medicaid, but as a state to say it would be cheaper if we did this. Are we talking about that at any level in government?
Commissioner Batson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, we do talk frequently with DHS and Department of Health on those issues, and specifically with respect to methamphetamine treatment, we are doing our own due diligence with respect to what really works and what doesn't. And as I mentioned earlier, the one thing that I think we do know is that longer period of aftercare is really essential. Getting folks into sober houses or to attend AA meetings, the 12-step program still seems to work. The other thing that seems to be essential is detoxification before treatment starts. That's another essential piece. And as I mentioned, many of the offenders that are in prison that we've talked to up at the boot camp said, you know, I couldn't have kicked this habit without being incarcerated. because it's all over out here, and it's such a highly addictive drug that the fact that they came to prison in a couple of cases now, I'm speaking anecdotally, but they have said, it saved my life, the fact that I came to prison, because I was away from it, I was able to detoxify and go to treatment and get out and get some of those wraparound services. So this is a little bit different kind of addiction. We're also going to be starting a program for youth up at our Thistledew camp, which I think addresses some of your question too. That's a can be a 3-month program, so it's much longer than the standard 28-day inpatient treatment. But again, I'm sure that the aftercare component is going to be critical. And yes, I think we continue to talk about these things, but as you know, treatment is expensive, and you know how much money we have to throw at this. I guess I don't know, but in our system we have a variety of different treatment approaches too. We have 30-day programs and we have 9-month programs for chemical dependency. So we, in our system, we do look at, you know, what works best for a particular offender type. But you know, we don't really get too involved in what's really going on out in the community long before they're committing crimes that might bring them to prison.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hausman, if I can have one more thing. I have been working pretty closely with DHS, Health, and the Department of Administration on how we might better purchase our health care. We privatized how our health care was delivered back in fiscal year 1999, and I think as a result of that, we've seen some pretty dramatic, or at least a slowing in the increases. It hasn't necessarily been a decrease. But one of the areas in particular that we've looked at very significantly is how we purchase our drugs, how we purchase our prescription medications. We spend about $3.3 million per year on medications, and we've been looking at with the Department of Admin as well as Department of Human Services on how we might better purchase our drugs.
Commissioner Benson, you've testified or spoken forcefully twice now this morning that a period of detox or incarceration should precede aftercare in order to effectively release someone who will be hopefully free of using meth. You've testified now that a period of detox or incarceration should precede that. Have you formulated an opinion as to how long that incarceration should be prior to the treatment?
Mr. Chair and members, I certainly am not going to pretend to be an expert, but having had some experience in this area with a family member, work very closely with the Hazleton program, and they like to see people off the drug for at least 30, 60, 90 days before they take a run at treatment. And then the aftercare period after treatment, after the 28-day inpatient, it's recommended up to a year. And they're almost insistent on that, particularly with methamphetamines, if you're going to have any success. So, again, that's what I've heard as I've worked with some of the folks in this particular program. And I don't think that's way out of whack, but this is a very new addiction and one that you know, I think is still evolving.
Commissioner Benson, I'm not trying to qualify you as any kind of a witness, but your opinion only. So I'm hearing you say a 90-day of strict incarceration or detox as step number one in handling a meth user who's in the system is appropriate.
Mr. Chair, to use our boot camp as an example, we require 4 months of incarceration before we would send them up there. And that, we've had some success with that. They will come to a facility, spend 4 months in the facility, then they go to the challenge incarceration program at Willow River, where there is a chemical dependency component, spend 6 months up there, and then they're released into a very structured, highly structured phase two piece of that program. And we've had pretty good success in terms of recidivism from that program. So again, that would be another piece of our experience that we would look to in terms of guiding our thinking as we approach this. Now, meth sentences, as you know, are very long. So to get people eligible for CIP, they have to be within their last 48 months as well.
Okay.
Mr. Chair.
We have Representative Paymar, then Eastland, and Hillstrom. Representative Paymar.
Well, it's more of a question for you, Chairman Smith, or just a suggestion. I'm glad that Representative Hausman raised the issue that she did, and the question, and the line of questioning that you have also to the panel, because I really think it would be helpful for this committee, especially on the policy end, to have like a whole committee just focused on the issue of drug offenses, drug sentencing, what treatment works, what treatment doesn't work, what you're currently doing. I've been on this committee since 1996, and I still don't know what all your drug programs are doing. And you make the comment, Commissioner Benson, that if treatment's expensive, incarcerating someone in prison's expensive. I think it costs $60,000 to house a juvenile in Red Wings. So, I mean, all of this is expensive, but it's a matter of what works, and it seems to me that we keep enhancing the sentences for drug offenders for what reason? And if there's an alternative out there, why aren't we exploring it? And it seems to me this committee should really have a frank discussion about all this. I think we're... I don't think this is a partisan issue. This is an issue that's costing the state an enormous amount of money, and we're the ones who are making that policy. I just hope that if there's time, sometime during the session here, maybe early on, if we could have a whole session just focused on this. That's my...
It's under advisement. It's under construction as well. Right. Representatives Eastland next.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I appreciate Representative Paymar's comments, and I guess I just based on the conversation, I mean, it seems like one of the pieces that we're missing here is the treatment piece. I mean, if they need to be incarcerated for a while, that's good. But what we're doing is we're not solving the problem, so we're incarcerating them longer. And if they need to be incarcerated for a while to detox, then if we're doing that, that's fine. If the problem is if they're getting out without treatment, then the next step is we should be providing treatment, not just more years in prison. And I think that's a critical philosophical thing we should look at, and hopefully we'll have some discussions about that. But I had a couple other questions. I'm still back on this chart where we're seeing this huge increase of methamphetamine people coming in for methamphetamine crimes. Do we have any kind of demographics of that group? Certain age, certain sex. How are they? Where are they? How do they fit the general cross section of the population? That's my first question. My second question is: do we have any information about the typical methamphetamine user that responds best to treatment? Is there any way to look at some information up front about a particular individual and know that individuals that fit this profile respond better to treatment than by age, by sex, is there some way that we could increase our bang for a buck for treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland, to the first question on demographics, that is something that we're pulling out as you speak. And we should be able to get that back to the committee here in a short turnaround.
Okay.
About 10% are females, and we've got a couple other demographics on the bottom here. But we'll get more details on that. As far as the treatment, I am not the expert in that area and haven't seen anything in there, but it's not within my field.
We need to, I'm going to go to Representative Hillstrom, then I think we're done with your general overview. Then we want to get to the budget deficiency item specifically. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made a statement that approximately 95% of the people at boot camp are meth offenders. Do we have any success rate yet? Have they been there long enough? Have we had any get out? Are they still off it? I mean, do we have any real success, or are we just thinking we're going to have success, or do we know?
Commissioner Benson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, you're correct. We have limited experience. Yes, we've moved a lot of people through the Challenge Incarceration Program who were addicted to meth, came to prison as a result of a meth conviction, and are out of prison. We can certainly get you those statistics. I don't have them with me today, but as you can see from our chart, it hasn't been around a long period of time, and again, relatively long sentences, so our experience is somewhat limited, but we can certainly share with you what we have.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a very serious epidemic, and I really worry about the children that are coming from these families, and if we can find that something like boot camp works for a short period of time, I think that really stabilizes, you know, families much faster. I found that in California, like 98% of the children that are never returned to a home are children that were removed from the house because of meth problems. And so it's a tremendous expense elsewhere, you know, in the child welfare system and in education and educating these. And so if we find that boot camp really does work, I mean, that is probably the cheapest thing and probably one of the shortest things, and I think one of the sentences that we should seriously look at.
Commissioner Betts.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hillstrom, just an observation. I think the one thing that I find most alarming with the meth, those that come in with a meth conviction, is half of them, it's their first, they have no prior felony. That's somewhat unusual in terms of our drug offenders. Most of the drug offenders, aside from methamphetamines, have a pretty lengthy history of some sort before they get to prison. But meth, they're coming in, about half of them, with no previous felony history, which is somewhat unique.
If there's no other questions, shift gears, tell us about our deficiencies that we need to figure out.
Mr. Chair and members, you have a handout that speaks to our deficiency initiatives, and I don't think there are any surprises here. We had most of these on the included in the bill last year, the deficiency bill last year that didn't pass. The largest item, of course, is the adjustment for population growth. We had 2.85 million in the deficiency budget. We desperately need some dollars to continue to rent beds. As I said earlier, in years gone by, we have always been able to find a few beds in a prison somewhere to squeeze in that unanticipated growth. But there's absolutely no more room at the corrections inn. We have to rent every bed now as we try to accommodate our growth, and that price is very fixed. It isn't flexible. Again, when we were able to add beds to a cell block, we could do it very cheaply. But now every bed at the Prairie Correctional Facility is $55 a day, and there are other costs that we also incur with that contract. We have contract monitors. We have transportation. We have health care costs that fall back to the state. We have some central office costs. So the actual cost today is just under $70 a day for every new offender coming into prison. And as we said earlier, we ended up with somewhere around, we're about 300 over where we thought we would be by the end of this biennium, so that has resulted in that $2.85 million request. In addition to that, in the institutions division, we're requesting $1 million for health care. We have a pretty significant and serious hole, so to speak, in our health care budget. It's actually, we're anticipating about a $3 million deficit this year. We were able to come up with a couple million dollars internally. We've done some things the last year and a half to really stop spending so that we could pay for additional health care costs. I'd also add that with respect to the population growth, the actual cost is about $6.5 million. We had some carry forward this last year that we saved in anticipation of this, but we couldn't get the entire $6.5 million. We're asking for $2.85 million. And then the health care, again, which is driven by a variety of things in terms of the deficit. There's some unfunded salary growth that we have to address. Our system is much larger. We actually lost about $300,000 in our equipment and supplies part of that budget, and just the health care inflation is a big piece. So again, we need that additional $1 million to meet the basic health care needs of our population. The other thing I would add, you've all heard about the meth mouth and the fact that the dental cost for meth offenders is extraordinary. We've got a photo here that we'll pass around that is of it's a meth mouth shot. The upper teeth have had some work done on them, the bottom haven't, and dental costs are going up dramatically. We have a waiting list now of about a year for somebody to get into a dentist unless it's the emergency, there's an emergency need. So those are the two items in the institution side of the agency, and Deputy Commissioner Nelson will speak to the $520,000 in the other side of the agency.
Commissioner Nelson, give us your name for the record and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Hurley Nelson, Deputy Commissioner. In the half a million there, the first one is hearing officers, and as those populations increases and increase and the number coming out on supervised release, there's going to be more revocations. And just to give you an idea, since 1998 to 2004, there's been about a 73% increase. And the largest portion of that came in the last year from 2003 to 2004. It went up 27%. So we had revocation hearings of 1,182 in 1998 and 2,045 in 2004. In addition to that, and Representative Murphy knows this, windshield time, some of these hearings are up in Roseau, Minnesota, which is about 375 miles away. And so we have people moving around the state quite frequently too, which takes some time. So we've needed to work more under the Morrissey hearing. They have to be heard at a certain time. I sat here too long and my voice went. The other area is risk assessment, community notification, the sex offender unit. And just to give you an idea of the increase in the workload there, this past year there has been over 1,000 cases that were screened. Of those, there's almost 300 reports that were done, and there was 170 that were referred to county attorneys to look for possible civil commitment. Our staff has done a tremendous job, but we've had to work more people than we had funded for just to keep up with that kind of workload. So these are two important areas here to make sure that we don't mess up as far as revocation hearings when many of these are sex offenders that are out there being supervised under intensive supervised release. We need to have those hearings and bring them back to prison when they're violating their technical violation of the technical rules. And we also need to do the notification meeting, which has been a dramatic increase also in our workload to our staff.
Question. Any questions? Commissioner Bent? Commissioner Baby? Anything further?
If there weren't any questions, we just had, and I promise we won't go through that whole handout that we gave you, but I think one of the things, you know, we talk about the budgets and we talk about prison overcrowding and we talk about all these things, but the real reality is the people that have to do these jobs. And I think that, you know, they are keeping Minnesota safe. We have the
in most cases, the worst of the worst locked up, and our staff, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, are dealing with issues, and that's not only in the prison, but in the field. And I think, you know, I think you all know the dangers that the, you know, law enforcement have, but it is amazing when you, you know, when we're part of the system for as many years as all of us have been, you don't really think about the dangers. And I don't think people, you know, in the public know what correctional officers and probation officers go through. When I was in Ramsey County, one of our IS intensive supervised release agents was going out on a night visit to make an unannounced visit. He looked down on his jacket, and there's an infrared scope, you know, on his jacket, and he ducked into the door that he was just ringing in the doorbell, and as the shots went down from an upper window. One of the things that I wanted to show is this briefcase. This is just from, we have collections from all of our facilities of weapons that the inmates fashion, and I just wanted to pass that around to show you the type of things that they're exposed to every single day. And the other thing, I just want to set up this little video that's about 3 seconds. At Oak Park Heights, when they are in segregation, and these are usually the people that have really severely, you know, assaulted the staff, this kind of thing. So in this clip that I'm going to show you, that the offender is handcuffed, he's got leg shackles on, he's in his cell 24 hours or 23 hours a day. We have to take him out by law. We have to take him out and exercise him. So in this video, I just want to show you that, set it up for what happens here. He headbutts him and breaks his nose. This is not, you know, it isn't unusual. This is unusual that when they're that restrained that something like this can happen. But it is, you know, often these kinds of things happen. And I think that, you know, one of the things that we're really concerned about when we're talking about the increase in getting enough money to rent the beds and not keep crowding people together, we've added 2,500 beds to existing facilities. We converted day rooms into multiple occupancy places, and we've done this with little or no money to do it. So at this point, we really need to do something. The bonding request is one of the most important things that I think can happen. The other thing that I really want to let you take a look at, I know you all heard about the, I had a bunch more. I know you all heard about the escape attempt, maybe in the middle, it was in the paper. We have very innovative prisoners, and as you know, we only have, we have counts a few times a day. Every prison has to count each one of the inmates to make sure they're there. There have been times when a dummy would be made in the bed to make it look like they're sleeping. So now we have to have standing help. So everybody has to stand up in their cell. This offender fashioned this dummy to be standing up at his sink at the end of the end of his cell, like he's washing his hair. His head is supposed to be bent over. And fortunately, we have very professional staff. We have staff that know what's going on, that, saw right away. When you're counting 1,400 people, it would be real easy to miss something like this. So I just want to bring the human side to it, that this is what we're dealing with every single day, this type of thing.
Well, Commissioner, that guy that did the headbutting in the video clip, he was already in shackles. What more could you do to him after the headbutting as a result of the headbutting? What'd you do to him after?
Put a foam helmet on him now. Oh, I mean, what more? He would just get more time at it because we do prosecute the assaults when they do that.
Any questions? Representative Houseman.
Just out of curiosity, is there a mental illness diagnosis?
I'm not sure of that particular one, but at Oak Park Heights, that's where we have our a regular mental health ward with how many beds is it? 45 beds for the very severely mentally ill inmates.
Thank you.
You know, do you want, Mr. Chair, do you want us to do any of, part of what this is just telling the different roles of the department and some of the challenges? We have actually talked about a lot of it in our first presentation, but I want to be respectful of your time, too.
You're coming back next Wednesday. You can hold this information and begin at this point then. So, in other words, no, we'll wait until
we've had enough, too.
Well, we've got time, but, you know, we also have time down the road. A couple things. The items you're passing around, were those taken as a result of some incident, or were they taken as a result of periodic checks? And where were they taken, from the cells or other places?
Mr. Chair and members, every institution has a routine of doing periodic lockups and shakedowns of various living units in various areas of the facility. Oak Park Heights, for instance, 8 living units, they probably lock up one unit every month or two, do a shakedown, and it's during the course of those shakedowns. And then we also do room checks almost on a daily basis at all of our facilities, and we would find some of those items during routine room checks. Many of them are found in common areas, in other words, not in their cell. They might be in an industry area, they might be in a work area, so that the offender can't be charged with it. But those all came from the Oak Park Heights facility over the course of several years. We have dramatically cut down on the contraband drugs being introduced into our correctional facilities since about 1996, when we went to a non-contact visiting, in that we now require that visitors sit across from the offender as opposed to next to them when they were hugging and kissing and embracing for a two-hour visit. That's when they were really bringing a lot of contraband into our correctional facilities. And we gauge that by our urinalysis. We do about 1 or 2% of our population every couple of months, and we're seeing very, very few dirty urines these days. Prior to the visiting policy change, there were probably 20 to 30% were dirty. Now it's down probably under 5%. So that's made a dramatic difference. The other thing that we've done in many of our facilities is added high-tech metal detectors. So the kinds of shanks or homemade weapons is changing. At Stillwater, for example, where they have lots of metal shops, we used to have lots of metal shanks, but in 1996 we brought in metal detectors, so they've kind of shifted to more plexiglass, more toothbrushes that are fashioned into a homemade weapon. So we try to stay ahead of the curve in terms of providing a safe working environment for our staff. But as the commissioner said, these guys are, they got lots of time, and they have unique imaginations too in terms of how they might smuggle contraband in or fashion some type of weapon.
When's the last time, Commissioner, you took meth off of a prisoner or out of their cell, if any?
Mr. Chair, I can't recall finding any meth in any of our facilities recently.
Well, you qualified the answer with recently. Have you? And if so, can you recall when was the last time?
Mr. Chair, why don't you let us get that information? We'll poll our facilities and get that information back to you.
That'd be fine, because frankly, another member of the House not on this committee has questioned me incessantly about this specific issue, and I'd like to know. to get rid of him if I can. Any other questions from anyone else on the committee? Any other questions? If not, thank you, Commissioner. It was a delight having you again, and I trust we'll see you again soon. And thank you very much. This committee is adjourned.